Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome back to Idle Red Hands, take three. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. Yeah, I guess the microphone's plugged in now.
Yeah.
All right.
Whoops.
Yeah, too bad, because we had some good jokes.
Yeah. Quite possibly the best episode ever.
I tell you, I was crying laughing. Crying.
Yeah. And then I was crying when I realized the mic wasn't plugged in.
Mm. Yeah. Oh, there's, so if our laughter sounds a little forced and canned...
We're just That's just Lyle.
That is a great joke. Ha, 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 ha.
Oh. Well done. Oh, my mum's gone back.
Oh, wow. Oh, I didn't know that.
And you know, in the first take, that was much smoother.
I thought it was about the same smoothness.
Yeah, so she tried Kobe beef while she was here.
Cool, cool. She liked it?
Yeah, it was my first time as well.
Hmm.
And we all liked it, but then afterward, it was so rich that we felt a little queasy afterwards.
So. I love this stuff. It's just, there's this little teppanyaki place down in San Omiya, and they make beautiful teppanyaki. The beef just melts in your mouth with it.
Man, what are you made of money?
Apparently so.
We go very rarely.
Oh, okay.
Mm. Especially, we don't go at all now that we are expecting baby.
Because Kobe beef.
It's expensive.
It's bloody expensive.
Oh, all right.
As our babies.
All right.
Hey, you can't eat both.
Really, babies once a month kind of meal.
The flavor kind of clashes, actually. Yeah, uh-huh. They don't complement each other. Uh-huh. She wouldn't try fugu or blowfish.
Because of the poison, or because it's
well, that didn't help.
Good.
Yeah. Well, it didn't help that we watched an episode of Columbo. Where the killer actually used fugu poison.
Oh, yeah, that might turn you off it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, unfortunately for you, the killer didn't use force-feeding Kobe beef to kill the guy, because that would have saved you some money, I'm sure. And would have gotten your mom to try the fugu.
Yeah. Hey, have you ever tried it?
Fugu? Yeah. It's pretty bland, huh?
Yeah.
It's just a basic white-fleshed fish, you know? And
much to do about nothing.
Mm.
What to say? Appetite is the ultimate... sauce. Mm-hmm. It was the best sauce. Mm-hmm. And I guess in Japan, fatality is the best sauce.
Poison. Poison. Sauce. Pretty much. You
in
know
this
what
was? The chefs shoot at you. It's great.
Yeah. I was thinking, it might be the kind of anything to spice it up. As Lyle said, it's like, well, it's just white fish, so how about we try some of this stuff that kills us, poison on it?
I think it has to do with the what's the word I'm looking for? The elegance of it?
The art of cutting it so that
exactly.
The person
like,
who eats
it
doesn't die?
Yeah, it takes someone who has a really high level of skill to be able to prepare it for you. Thus, it's very impressive.
Ah, if only that skill translated into flavor.
Could you cut the flavor part out?
Yeah. Could you cut it so that it tastes better?
Yeah,
it's weird. My ex-girlfriend's grandfather, he used to have a little vial of fugu poison that he kept around, and he used to put it on his lower lip. It made his whole mouth tingle. I have no idea to this day why, but yeah.
Did you try to kiss the grandmother afterwards?
Try to get rid of her.
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe if it made his mouth tingle, maybe it was like a numbing agent and he wanted to perform dental work on himself.
I don't know.
Well, I was thinking a bit racier than that. I don't know why I thought that, though. I don't know why you needed numb things, too.
I don't know if he enjoyed it, or if maybe he thought it was some kind of medicine or something. I don't know.
He, in fact, hated it. But he thought he was so hardcore. Fugu poison.
And I'm sure he screamed like that when he did it, too. This is fugu!
No, I mean, it'd be like a bit more numb. Like,
he would talk like, just came back from the dentist.
Yeah.
Is this real life?
Oh, that little boy?
Yeah.
No, it's just fugu poison.
That viral video got a whole lot more interesting. But, yeah, it seems like it's fading. It is. Go towards the light, son.
There,
is it supposed to be cold? It's summertime. I just got the AC on.
Well, today we're going to be talking about mysteries.
Such as what happened to that little kid. Maybe we're right.
Prepare for it. I watched up the new Sherlock Holmes movie with Robert Downey Jr.
I've seen that as well.
Mm.
Where Robert Downey Jr. is playing himself. Imagine he's
Robert
Sherlock
Downey
Holmes.
Jr. as Robert Downey Jr.
playing Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, Robert Downey Jr. with armor, without armor, yeah. Doesn't matter. Those are his movies.
Yeah, it wasn't bad per se. Like, I liked the twist in the end. It was good, but I don't know, the movie as a whole just eh. It was almost like a superhero movie, but played into a Sherlock Holmes, stuffed into a Sherlock
it's
Holmes.
It's almost like the costume. Guy who made Snatch decided to make a Sherlock Holmes movie. Oh no, it was yeah. Exactly. The
same. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I didn't mind the movie. You just watch it once. I doubt if I'll ever watch it again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually like what they did with Sherlock Holmes. Mm-hmm. I prefer the original Sherlock Holmes.
The way he changed his character, or like the fast fighting thing?
Yeah, where they made Sherlock Holmes Robert Downey Jr. Who yeah. Except a pit fighter.
Yeah.
And I could have done without the fast, slow, what is it, the ramping?
That's what it said online. Yeah. I don't know. And when I was in film school, we just called it slow motion.
Yeah.
Matrix time.
No, that's bullet time. It's a little different, I think.
Oh, all right. But, like, as you said, like, I know why they did it.
Because I understand why as well.
Yeah. I would say it's kind of hard to show in, like, a visual media somebody thinking fast. Well, I mean,
they could try acting.
Well, you can do the slow motion thing. That's fine, you know. Have everything going in slow motion and have him thinking at regular speed. That's fine. You don't need to do the slow, fast, and make him such a badass, too.
Right.
I suppose so, but I don't know. Like,
I just don't. Like, I can see Sherlock Holmes thinking really well, like, okay, hit this pressure point and then box him on the ears or something like that. But I don't see him, like, kicking a guy through a fence kind of thing.
Nah, because, I mean, like, if you read, like, Sherlock Holmes, I don't think he ever got physical.
Well, that was never his deal. He was cerebral.
Yeah, I've been reading some Sherlock Holmes in preparation for this, and I'm, you know, sometimes he would just go, Watson, go bring a gun. Meet me at this restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
Bring a gun. Don't get stopped by the cops.
Yeah, he would put, like, a gun in his pocket. And, yeah. Like, he would carry a gun with him sometimes, too, but I don't think he ever really used it on anyone.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, he's definitely like your Columbo or your mentalist, mm-hmm. you know, Patrick Jane, where everything is about thinking. But I mean, you watch, like, the old Sherlock Holmes series, or you watch, like, a movie,
mm-hmm.
relatively recent movie, The Hound of the Baskervilles, and you get a strong sense through the guy's actual acting
mm-hmm.
that he's more intelligent than everybody around him.
Yeah.
So I don't see why you need fast mm-hmm. and slow motion to convey that.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Maybe just Robert Downey Jr. couldn't do that?
Yeah.
He seemed more Robert Downey Jr. than anyone around him.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah.
Maybe it was to differentiate the Robert Downey Jr. that we saw in Iron Man.
Yeah, right.
From the Robert Downey Jr. in Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, that's right. That's weird. Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man, the superhero, didn't do the fast slow motion thing, but as Sherlock Holmes they did.
Yeah, and Tony Stark's supposed to be intelligent.
Yeah. Which I suppose I didn't really get that in Iron Man anyway, so.
Not the fact that he was a jerk, but.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm just tired of the fast slow after watching 300.
I don't know. Like, I actually don't mind it. I think it looks cool. I mind it when they have Sherlock Holmes doing it, but as a film device, I don't mind it at all. So
I think I'm in the same camp.
Hmm.
This is Elementary!
This is overdone!
Okay, so when we're talking about mysteries, we're actually talking about your classical mystery story.
Mm-hmm.
Like Sherlock Holmes, and not the Robert Downey Jr. version.
Right. Now, not necessarily, we're not going to be talking about lying and how to do that, because we already did on that episode.
Mm-hmm.
Still up on the website. Secrets and Lies.
It's a good one.
We'll wait while you go listen to it.
We'll be here when you come back.
All right. And we're back. Or you're back.
Yeah.
So, we're going to be talking about mysteries, which is a big challenge.
Tell me about it.
To do. And especially because, you know, when you're borrowing elements from movies or stories, that's quite difficult to translate into a game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because the writer, let's say the mystery writer, they want the reader to be fooled.
Right.
Whereas you as a game master, you want the players to succeed.
Right. And the mystery books and stories, they often rely on some pretty big cognitive leaps to catch the mystery, and that's something that you can't guarantee at all.
Right. So we're going to be talking about that this episode and trying to either try to give tips on how to run a mystery or how to incorporate those elements into a regular game.
Mm-hmm.
So we've decided to divide it into three parts, a mystery story into three parts. The hook and the motivation,
mm-hmm.
the antagonist or adversary, And, of course, the clues, the big challenge. All right, so what's the hook or motivation, Wayne? How do you get players interested in your mystery?
I think there's two kind of broad ways you can get the characters and hopefully the players interested in the mystery. And that is the characters have to be involved either professionally or personally in the mystery. Basically, sometimes professional interest can become personal interest, but that doesn't always have to happen. I see it as, like, the characters would either have to be, you know, policemen or detectives or, like, a Sherlock Holmes type character where solving mysteries is their profession, and that's why they would be interested in the mystery, or they have to be connected to the mystery personally, such as the thing happened to them or a family member or any other way you could tie it in there.
Yeah.
To get the characters and hopefully the players interested in the mystery.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, and you can do both as well. You know, maybe this starts out as just a job, but then gets into something personal.
Well, yeah. I think that often happens in a lot of detective stories.
It never goes the other way, does it?
No. It started personal, now it's just a job.
They killed my wife, but yeah, whatever. They started paying
now I'm paid,
me,
so. Paid to solve her crime.
Yeah.
I'm over it.
Either that or you solved the crime,
yeah,
and you liked it so much that it became a job. But that would be backstory. That wouldn't actually be the mystery story itself.
If it were a short or an episodic kind of adventure, I could see that being where professional would be a good motivation. But if we're going to be a longer mystery, I think it would almost have to be personal, wouldn't it? And it wouldn't have to be, but wouldn't you really want it to be able to get the characters more deeply involved?
Going the personal angle would hopefully get them more involved, but I don't think you have to do that. Like, if you think about, like, a detective story where the guy kind of keeps getting away, then...
And you're right.
It becomes a little bit personal in that the cops or the people, the detectives, want to catch this guy more than it just being a job, but it still just is... professional.
Yeah.
I mean, like, nothing personally happened to them. It's just, this guy keeps eluding us, and all these... It's not... I guess it's personal in a larger sense in that this guy has committed crimes against humanity or whatever, and therefore we want to catch him, but he hasn't really done anything to me personally, other than elude capture.
And, like, we said Sherlock Holmes is one of the biggest names in mysteries, and he usually kept a professional distance in his stories as well, so...
Yeah, if you watched, like, episodes of Monk or... Columbo, those are a really good example of... Sorry, go on.
Oh, but that's the thing that I was saying, is that in an episodic sense, it makes perfect sense to keep it as a professional thing. Because then, if it's really personal, then you kind of need a cool-down time after it's over. But if it's just a job, then you can do one after the other. But if it were in a movie, it's... Even in the Sherlock Holmes movies, he gets personally involved in whatever case he's in. In the example that I can think of, anyway.
What? The actual Sherlock Holmes movie?
Yeah. Doesn't he? Because that's because the woman gets involved, but again, that's personal involvement.
I think, that's a good example where they made it more personal, but I think they made it more personal than the original Sherlock Holmes
movies. Like, yeah, we said the character is pretty far from the original.
I actually wasn't disagreeing with you. I was just saying that if you watch those episodes, especially Monk, like, he's very detached.
Yeah. Mm.
Like, you know, come upon a dead body. I just watched a recent episode. He comes upon a dead body on their way home on the highway. And it's just very much, it's a
dead body
puzzle. Yeah, let's solve this. I know it's a dead body, so it's kind of like my job or what I do.
And same thing, like the Law and Order, as well, as it's very, very professional.
Yeah, throughout. Except for a special victims unit, and that can get a bit weepy.
Yeah. But again, like I said, that's also an episodic kind of sense, so that makes sense to keep it in a professional level.
Yeah. But I don't.
Can I actually finish my point?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So it's if you watch those episodes and you think that will make a great story, then you could do the professional game. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you, Chris, in that if you want to have something that will sustain itself over a number of sessions, where the players would be like, really jazzed at the end.
Yeah.
To have solved it, then you should do kind of like a hard-boiled story where they generally start professional. Mm-hmm. You know, Sam Spade gets called in on the job, but now his life gets put into danger.
Yeah.
So then it becomes more than just a job. It becomes personal.
Right.
I think that would lead to a more rewarding finish.
I actually don't know if I would want to play in an episodic mystery game, such as if you were going like on like Monk or Columbo.
One mystery after the other?
Yeah, I think that would get kind of boring for the players, and it would get really difficult for the GM to have to come up with all these mysteries.
I'm not sure if it would be boring, but yeah, it certainly would be difficult for the Game Master to consistently come up with these different mysteries, because it's not their job to make these stories, whereas a mystery writer, that's their job, and they're going to crank them out.
Yeah,
and they can manipulate, like you said, they control the story and the narrative so much that what they hide and don't hide, or what they reveal or hide, they have a lot of say in, whereas in a game, you don't know what the players are going to do. You don't control the characters. So.
Yeah, and then, you know, the characters make their own backgrounds, too, so...
Well, I think you brought up background. I think if you're going to do a mystery, and if you're going to make it, as you guys said, it kind of has to become personal to keep the players interested in for a long campaign, then I think that's a good point where the GM would need to have some say over the background. And not like veto power, but... I mean, you would
GM should keep that anyway.
Yeah, but you would kind of have to set up, okay, I'm drawing a blank here, but you'd probably have to say, like, these are things that I would need, or I need a real person with, you know, connections and people they're attached to, and...
Because, so, a background, not just something thrown together.
Yeah.
Okay.
What I meant, like, a real person, I don't mean, like, even if we're doing, like, a fence, like, oh, he's a fighter. Okay, I need a bit... more than that, you know. Mm. So, like, if the guy came up with like the loner, then is that really going to work?
Because, I have no friends.
Yeah, exactly. Well, then it's like, well, what strings do I have to pull on you to keep you interested? I don't have anything really.
Well, a lot of times when players get stymied, and I was going to bring this up into clues, but it fits here, and they kind of just hit a wall. Sometimes, and you see that again, and see this a lot in Hard Boiled. They just stir up trouble. Mm-hmm. It's like what Sam Spade says. He just throws a monkey wrench into it. So, if they stir up trouble, then that can get people after them.
Yeah.
This Fallout, I think that's more similar to like a thriller-style mystery, where they're kind of solving a little crime and finding out that it's actually a small piece to the big crime. Whereas a more traditional mystery, like a cozy, or even like a procedural, there's that one crime.
Yeah.
And it's all about finding who committed that crime. Whereas in a thriller, you perhaps very quickly discovered who committed the first crime, but find out they're just like a henchman or a very small part of a big puzzle. And then kind of the mystery is how to stop the big crime.
Yeah.
Not just solve the big crime, but how to stop it.
Definitely. Or if you're going the NCIS route, there are two separate crimes. And you're watching because you think they may have a chance of actually connecting somehow. And so you watch the episode and no, they never do.
In NCIS?
I think they do that. Usually there's like two...
Do you mean CSI?
Maybe CSI or NCIS. I think NCIS possibly does
Navy
it
or not Navy?
But I think both do it.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not mixing up the two, but I think they both do it. How there's like two separate little mysteries, and you're like, oh, maybe this time they'll connect. And no,
I think CSI is the one where they have the two teams.
Ah.
And they kind of did that formula.
You keep watching because you're like, oh, maybe this is the one episode where they're related. No! Ah!
No, crap, I stopped watching CSI a long time ago. Yeah. You ever watch CSI Miami?
Ow!
Yeah. Okay, that was the theme song. It's just like...
No, there's a theme scream.
Like David Caruso, like, solves everything.
Those one-liners are
great.
Why
isn't he a team?
Exactly. Why does Miami need a police force? They've got David Caruso.
Exactly.
The most ridiculous thing I ever saw him do. There's a long list.
Bullet time.
Yeah. Where the coroner is actually standing over the body, declaring death, and is about to stick in the like liver thermometer to see, you know, the temperature of the liver. And he goes, he's not even like kneeling over the body. He's kind of standing over the body. He's like, hold on. Why is that body sweating? And of course, coroner's like, oh, how come I never noticed that? And it's like, well, you're not David Caruso.
You're fired.
I think that kind of speaks to like, obviously, if you're going to do like a game with a group of players, then it does have to be a team. And kind of one person can't be the David Caruso of the team unless that's kind of what you want to play, you know? Because I imagine that would get pretty frustrating. It's like, wait a minute. I'm the coroner. I have all these medical skills. How come I didn't see the sweat?
Yeah.
This guy over here, he saw it? He wasn't even in the room!
And that's one of the big challenges in making a mystery game, in that is that you don't have the brilliant detective. like a Sherlock Holmes, mm-hmm. that to make those huge leaps in logic. So
yeah, and that's the thing, you know, it's a it. You want the players to be able to get the mystery. They want to solve themselves, and it's not a matter of rolling the dice and then catching on what it's going to be. I suppose it could be, but that's not nearly as interesting. It's so you're really playing to the players, not to the characters.
Mm-hmm.
So
the next big element in a mystery is
the adversary.
The adversary.
The antagonist.
The antagonist. And I think the big thing to consider with that person is, mm-hmm. of course, revealing the identity is generally the big reveal.
Mm-hmm.
Or discovering the identity is generally the big reveal. Like, who did it?
Yeah.
It's not a what did it. Yeah.
Well, it could be if it were D&D, but...
Yeah, I suppose.
The orcs are bad! No!
Now, what are some things that you would consider when making your mystery adversary?
Motivation.
Mm-hmm.
First off, I think that's one of the biggest and most important things. Not just in a mystery, but in almost any making of an adversary, because that determines how they're going to act. And as if they have some kind of evil plot that's moving along and the characters are interfering with it, they will eventually react to the PCs in some way. And having a motivation really helps you know how and what they would do.
I think I'm going to build on that by saying I would the motivation of why this thing should be kept secret.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you think about, like, a murder, well, like, if there's a murder, like an innocent person, or maybe even a guilty person,
mm-hmm.
some people would turn themselves in. And obviously, there's no mystery anymore because
right.
they've done it. But for there to be a mystery, someone has to want the truth to remain a secret. So
not necessarily. It doesn't have to be. Somebody doesn't have to be actively hiding it.
Really?
Well, you could do a mystery of, like, you find a dead body on the beach, you have to find out what happened.
But it
doesn't have to be an antagonist that's blocking your path the whole way.
Well, but even so, if that's the case, then someone threw the body, or someone dumped the body into the ocean,
mm-hmm.
and why did that person do that? Because they didn't want anyone to find the body and know that they killed him, so
right.
that action was them trying to keep things secret.
I see, why they didn't turn
the players, yeah, the players just saw the end.
But I think you raise a good point, Chris, about actively trying to foil you versus what Wayne was saying is like all of it is done kind of before the game starts.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you can take two approaches there. Do you have an active adversary who is continuously trying to foil the players?
Who done it versus who's doing it?
Oh, we're just going to get a lot of mileage out of this, I sense.
Yeah.
I think the big thing I consider when I make an adversary in a mystery is not cheating.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I become very aware, and a couple of things, there's some tips for mystery writers, and one of them is that you need to, like, the person who committed the crime has to be a significant character in the story.
Yeah.
And the players should meet that person early, and perhaps not often, because the players might not choose to continuously go back, but mm-hmm. they certainly have the opportunity to encounter them. Now, if you have a completely shadowy person who's only going to be revealed at the end, of course that's good in some stories, but I think it's more rewarding if it was always right there. It's like the in plain sight.
Because mm-hmm.
then there's more opportunity to discover or more avenues to find out.
Yeah, and even if you do have some kind of shadowy, hidden adversary, it shouldn't be sprung immediately upon them. Give them clues that this shadowy adversary exists.
Mm.
They see a shadow early on in the adventure, creeping past the wall.
Because that's not suspicious at all.
Well, it is suspicious, and that might be a motivation for them finding it. But, yeah.
It's the thing I was going to say about adversaries is, like, in addition to motivation, I kind of what you said, Lyle, like, the fact that they're presented kind of at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
I would argue that the adversary has to be capable of whatever the mystery is.
Oh, definitely.
Like you said about not cheating. Because back when I was going to run that Horror Musketeers game,
mm-hmm.
I'd wanted to cut out like all the supernatural mm-hmm. elements from it, kind of like the movie The Brotherhood of the Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
I was basing it on that. And it was really hard to design a mystery using only mundane elements.
Really?
No supernatural elements, because if you do it in, like, a fantasy, then...
You can just say magic.
Yeah, magic.
Yeah.
You know, magic is kind of the catch-all, or things can happen. And again, the players would have the same tools to solve the mystery, but it sometimes it makes the mystery able to be more mysterious,
mm-hmm.
right?
I guess I'm to add to that when you're done, though.
Sure. But trying to do it with only sort of mundane things, and I know, you know, reality is stranger than fiction, but making, as a GM, making those cognitive leaps was pretty difficult. Like, okay, well, how do you explain that nobody saw this guy? Or how do you explain that the body ended up here?
Yeah,
you know, how do you explain all these things when you don't have the ability to fall back on spells or potions or magic? There has to be a logical reason for everything that happened.
Mm.
And that could be quite difficult.
But I would argue that magic, just saying magic, is not a good excuse at all. I remember in a D&D 3.5 edition I played years ago, the DM followed the rules of the D&D magic system. There was nothing that any of the enemies did that wasn't already a spell that the players could look up and find in one of the books. And I think that added a lot to it, because it you know that the GM is playing by the same rules that you are.
Right.
I don't think saying just, it's magic.
I wasn't saying that you can just hand wave the thing away by saying, oh, it's magic.
Mm-hmm.
I was still thinking that, yeah, whatever magic happened, the players would still have access to, like opening the book and saying, oh, well, they maybe used a spell of levitation or whatever.
Yeah.
But I saw it as, it was one more tool to make the mystery more mysterious.
A tool or a crutch?
Possibly both.
Because I think we're all agreeing, it's like, you don't cheat.
Right.
Yeah.
That whatever the rules are of the world are the rules.
Yeah.
And there are different ways to cheat. One is the adversary plays by a different set of rules.
Right.
Another one is to change who is the bad guy halfway through, because the players are getting close to the...
Or they guessed it too quickly.
Yeah, they guessed it too quickly. So instead of running with that, you're like, well, I'll change who it is. And then on the flip side, they're not guessing it.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than manipulate the clues, you just say, okay, they're kind of going towards this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he's the killer. Right. Because you realize...
They're
not going to go the other direction, so you might as well reward their side.
Stubbornness.
Yeah, reward their stubbornness.
Their tenacity.
And I know we've talked about that, and I've always, you know, I'm very much against that. And I know some people, and I've read online, will suggest there's nothing wrong with changing the killer. But I would disagree. It's because I see that just as another form of cheating.
Yeah. I can see how a case could be made for, you know, maybe if there's some reason that the story would radically improve if it were one person over another. But yeah, in general, I agree.
Yeah, I guess so. If you're like, no, actually, that would be a better killer.
Yeah.
Because I never thought about that would be a good motive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly better than my he's just angry motive or whatever.
He's angry. Yeah. He's evil.
Yeah.
I forget where it was, but I've read an article where the person suggested that there should be multiple suspects and... sort of all the when you make the adventure, you should have, you know, multiple people who have the motivation, the ability, and the chance to do this or to commit the crime. And then as the players kind of proceed, you know, down as the story advances, based on the players' choices, you can choose who did it, and you haven't invalidated any of the choices that the players made.
That could build a lot into the adventure. Like the player, assuming that the players went down one road only, but if they started investigating everyone and found that everyone had equal levels of motivation and ability to
those
crimes, then, I mean, that could add a lot, because now you're working to eliminate the various suspects. But
they were suggesting that the clues point to one person,
mm-hmm.
but not a specific person, right? And then the game master kind of behind the screen, kind of either after a few sessions or in the middle of the adventure, kind of says, okay, it'll be this guy. They've found the clues, or they're kind of going down this path, so I'll make it this guy.
And you just hope that it's that the game master's not a jerk and says they're going down this path, so I'll choose the other path.
Well, but it almost wouldn't matter what path they're going down, since all the possible suspects are just as equally as capable of pulling this off.
No, I don't disagree with that. Right. I kind of disagree with the...
changing it mid-session.
Or kind of having it up in the air. I understand. I understand the advantages to that. It still seems to me a little bit like cheating.
Right.
But I think, having a variety of possible suspects with motives and that does help you with the mystery, because then it allows you to play with that with your main villain. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, maybe the main villain doesn't have an apparent motive. Mm-hmm. Maybe you'll find out later what it is, but it's being overshadowed by somebody, some other suspect, the ex-husband. Mm-hmm. That's who killed this woman. And that's used a lot when you watch TV or read the books. It's like, somebody dies, they go to the immediate family first.
Right.
Other things could be the crime doesn't match the personality type, but it matches somebody else's personality mm-hmm. type. So it's a crime of passion, but this person seems very calculating.
Yeah. Go on. In a game that you could take that to the extreme in that the crime doesn't match the person's ability. This person was
killed
with magic, not with a sword.
Oh, yeah. And that would kind of try to force you to add at least one more dimension to that character, mm-hmm. whether or not they're putting up the cold facade, but they're really, rage mm-hmm. personified, or if they seem to be a fighter, but this seems to be a magical crime, and to find out that they're actually skilled in both, mm-hmm. Or they're a child.
Yeah. Definitely. I think that's a slight difference between the way a lot of mystery movies and books go versus games, is that games tend to have a big showdown at the end with the villain. And the villain tends to be a very powerful character, physically powerful. Whereas in a lot of books and movies, they find them and then... Well, no, actually, I take that back. There is a showdown usually. It's often not as fantastic as a game, but there's still like Silence of the Lambs, the hunt in the basement, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's different types. Like, there's in the cozy, there's, the drawing room showdown.
Yeah. Oh, what was that famous author who always had the kind of everyone gathered in one room and the detective
revealed? Agatha Christie.
Thank you, thank you, yes.
Yeah, Poirot would, mm-hmm. would then reveal who did it.
It was the butler.
Other locations are the interrogation room. Mm-hmm. You see that a lot in procedurals. But, yeah, there is a case for, the lair. Like, you see that in... Hard-boiled, or you read that in Hard-boiled, or in the thriller, mm-hmm. where you track them down, and now it is going to be, shoot them out.
Yeah.
I think it kind of depends on, partly on who the characters are and what kind of story you're telling. Like, for example, if, I'm thinking like if the characters work for the government, like if they're part of the police force, then there's obviously rules they have to follow. So unless the criminal is dangerous and threatening them, there probably wouldn't be that big showdown, that gunfight. Mm-hmm. But in like a typical D&D fantasy campaign, the players are essentially vigilantes. So, I mean, yeah, they kind of have to work within the law, but they could just sort of leave the city. And so there could be that big kind of knockdown, drag out fight. So if you're going, if you're playing a more like, I don't know, subdued or cerebral tone game, then it could be a big surprise to have a big violent showdown fight at the end to mm-hmm. kind of shake things up. But I think that would lend itself more to like the drawing room reveal mm-hmm. where no one's really going to do anything because they know they've been defeated.
I don't know. I don't see the drawing room or parlor room reveal as going over all that well in a game, because for a book, it works with the reader because the detective, he's caught it on and he lets the reader know, and the reader's like, oh, yeah, it makes sense. But if the players are the ones solving mystery, then they know the answer. It's only going to be the NPCs going, oh, and
you've got me.
Yeah, what does it matter if the NPCs are surprised,
And also, you got to think of the party dynamics. And sure, some of them might be very cerebral, and maybe that barbarian was a big help in in intimidating some of the people to give some witnesses, to give them clues. Mm-hmm. But you don't really want to then put, Thundar the Barbarian in the drawing room.
It was Butler.
Yeah, Butler did it, and that's good.
Actually, I could see that.
It was the candlestick. That's really...
The animated candlestick.
It was the candlestick that killed the other candlestick.
I don't know, I could see a drawing room style reveal kind of being the opener to not like a big mystery, but I'm imagining like, let's say you find out that the prince did it, and so now someone of high stature, and your implication is really going to shake things up in the world that the story takes place in, then it is going to be kind of a big deal about this reveal, and then the story kind of doesn't stop, and the story is, almost becomes the aftermath of this this implication and what happens.
Mm-hmm. You're almost saying like a throne room reveal.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking of, you know?
That'd be pretty cool.
So even if there is a fight, then, again, people still have to deal with the consequences of, you know, the nation is in tatters, the king's dead, and there's these pretenders to the throne, and what's going to happen, and the players are complicit in this.
That's really cool.
So, again, you would kind of have to set that up from the beginning. But.
Well, I think that'd be, like, that idea there, starting on that scene, on the reveal scene.
I was actually thinking you could play a short mystery mm-hmm. before that, but then the story wouldn't really kick off until that throne room reveal scene.
Yeah, and it's figuring out after that, kind of going with that adventure, figuring out how they did it and all that. But I suppose that brings us to clues, one of the biggest parts of a mystery.
The biggest part.
Yeah. And actually, a lot of this topic came from reading an article online, the Three Clue Rule essay by Justin Alexander, where he broke it down where mysteries are made up of revelations from characters, where they have to realize that, of course, the biggest one is who is the killer, or Tim Barzovit, like, this person was killed with a candlestick, or in the drawing room. And breaking down those elements into what kind of clues could lead the characters to reach those revelations. And he suggested that for each revelation that you have, you want to give the characters three clues to be able to figure it out. Three chances, at least, yeah, at a minimum. And, yeah, I think it's an absolutely fantastic idea.
Yeah, basically, for every conclusion you want the players to make,
yeah,
give them at least three clues because for them to make it with.
Yeah, it's far too easy for them to miss or ignore or just not even realize that a clue is a clue. And even if they found the clue, to not be able to fit it into the whole puzzle.
I think one of the warning things he said in that essay or that article was if a clue becomes a bottleneck.
Mm-hmm.
That's really dangerous for the story.
Yeah.
And the classic example is the dungeon with the secret door.
Yes.
Which is the only way to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
And you're relying on the players finding that secret door. And yeah. if they don't, the story grinds to a halt.
Mm-hmm.
And the players get frustrated. And that's pretty much the end of the story. You're relying on something random, like a secret door check or anything. And if they don't find that clue, the game's done.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was saying look at your story and identify the bottlenecks.
Right.
Yeah.
And then provide three clues in which to overcome that bottleneck.
And also, if possible, create an alternative route mm-hmm. so that it is not a bottleneck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's a similar rule that came in, it's in GURPS Mysteries mm-hmm. by Lisa Steele, and that's the rule of seven. And just kind of like limit yourself to like seven named NPCs. So I guess you could do that. Like she says seven clues, but you can combine that with the rule of three,
mm-hmm.
like seven revelations.
Yeah.
And each revelation would have three different clues in which to...
Yeah, I think they said something. I forget
seven key items.
I forget where I read this, but it was something about mathematics and that the human brain can remember seven things.
That's why phone numbers are 7 digits long.
Yeah, and then once you start...
Except in Japan.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why no one remembers. They just exactly. program it into their phone and hit go.
But you don't know your own phone number?
I know my own phone number.
But,
right. But anyway, once you start getting past seven elements or seven items, people have trouble remembering stuff. So yeah, it was trying to limit to seven elements.
That's interesting. Yeah, I'd actually heard the whole idea of breaking down plot by revelations and by the clues in there. I read it on John Drain's GMing blog. Good blog, by the way. But the idea of the three clue rules that to provide overlapping clues is it seems so simple, but it's such a brilliant idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can make them different types of clues.
Oh, you should make them different types of right. clues so that different characters... Oh, sorry, please.
No, finish my point.
I usually do that.
I'm sorry, I was improving your point.
Just kidding, I'm sorry. Just kidding.
For example, one could be the motivation, other could be like their job or the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the third could be?
Could be an item.
Oh, I think. Yeah. I was waiting for that third one.
All right. I was waiting for my point to be finished again. But what about hiding clues? So that's good to always have three clues for every revelation.
Yeah.
Or every possible bottleneck. But you still want to make it somewhat of a challenge. You always want the players to succeed in this story and to find these clues because where don't. The story doesn't go anywhere if they just go, oh, we're stuck.
Absolutely.
But you should still make it fun, and in a mystery, the clues are hidden. So what are some ways to hide the clues so that the players could conceivably still find them?
Oh, I forget where I read this, but maybe it was part of the gumshoe system, where they suggested that if the player has the skill, or their character has the skill needed to find the clue, they automatically find the clue.
I was going to bring up the same thing.
Right.
And it's not, I don't think it's based on the skill, I think, and I might be wrong, that it's based on the scene. In this scene, if you need a clue, if you need information to go to the players, they will automatically get it. If they have the skill, I think they get extra information.
Maybe that's
it. And if
it.
They roll well, then they get more and more, etc.
I think that might be
right.
it.
But.
So it's not exactly hiding the clue,
mm-hmm.
because as we said, if the players don't find the clues, then the story doesn't progress.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a way to kind of hide the clue or to make the player's luck or skill matter, in that they'll automatically find a very small clue, I would argue, or something to propel them to the next scene.
Mm-hmm.
But the better they do, the more information they get, and possibly the easier it will become
mm-hmm.
for them. So,
yeah, you can ways of hiding them, because obviously you don't want to conceal the clue from them, or rather you don't want to conceal the clue from them in a way that they're going to fail. Mm. So give them something that will cause them to search. For example, if you're hiding a room, if you have an object that's hidden in a desk drawer or underneath a desk drawer or something like that, have them find something else that was hidden. But it's very easy. It's not an important item, but it might trigger the idea to search the room mm-hmm. for other hidden items.
Yeah.
You can hide items with other items that might or might not relate to the mystery, though you're kind of getting into red herring territory there. For example, if this pen is important to the mystery, they find also a magnifying glass in a shoe, and you give them, these are the items you find.
Mm-hmm. Well, I sense our killer wore a size 9, had bad eyesight, and wrote in blue ink.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, or you give a list of things. I had down here hide among a list of other things.
Yeah.
So you have the killer's name is among a list of other people that were at the party.
Yeah.
Kind of like almost like hiding things in plain sight there.
Yeah, that's exactly Absolutely. What it is.
Yeah.
You could also give the killer or the main suspect an alibi. That will crumple upon investigation.
Ooh, that's a good one, yeah.
Yeah. You could also... One is you have an obvious motive, but it's not the actual motive for the killing, so they kind of look at that. But in investigating that motive, they start to kind of bit like the chain reaction.
That's kind of like misdirection a little bit, then.
And that's, again, another example of why the having three clues is important.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you gave the players this alibi, and under investigation, sure, the alibi is going to crumble entirely, but they might not investigate. They might say, oh, okay, so you're innocent, and then try to investigate the next person.
Yeah, I think I've used this analogy before, but it's kind of like the locked door.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you design something, yeah, the door is locked, but you really want the players to either pick the lock, break down the door, go through a window, try another door.
Hmm.
But sometimes the players will, oh, the door's locked.
All right, let's go
away. And that can be like with the motive or the alibi or, mm-hmm. or anything. They'll go, oh, he's got an alibi. Yeah, it's probably airtight.
Mm-hmm.
Move on. Not thinking that, oh, his wife is providing that alibi or this ex-con, somebody mm-hmm. he was in prison with, is providing the alibi.
And even if they do get misdirected and completely ignore it.
Yeah.
It's a good excuse to use it later on. You know, if the person mm-hmm. says, oh, no, I was with my wife that day, and say, okay, ignore it. Then later on you find out, wait, he doesn't have a wife. Then it's immediately go back to that. And that's a very good reveal for the players, too.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's why it's a good idea that the players or characters have a very strong motivation, either professional or personal, to continue searching. Because when they do hit that locked door,
mm-hmm.
if they want to solve the mystery, hopefully they won't just give up. They will either, you know, try and go through a window or pick the lock. But if they're not that interested, I think there's a bigger chance of them just saying, well, the door is locked, and all right, let's go back home, essentially, and they'll stop searching. With a strong motivation, they'll keep going.
Right.
And then they'll find that, you know, that, yeah, the guy doesn't have a wife, or, hey, no, this guy says you were with him,
mm-hmm.
which is different, and they'll get back on the right track.
Right. Yeah, what did Raymond Chandler say? If the story starts the lull, send in the guys with guns.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then you have a whole other mystery.
Yeah.
Whoa, wait. Wait a minute. Yeah, who are those guys? Why are they trying to kill us?
I thought we were doing Murder, She Wrote. You realize I'm like 70. Another thing, and I think this one's a big challenge, but you'll see this a lot in a mystery story, is something is missing that was there before, or some things are happening that shouldn't be happening, or not happening that should be happening. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to broaden that, because it could also be, you know, when the killer is very familiar, or something, a killer, the detective is very familiar with the setting, or the city, the train schedule, for example, and they realize that the train actually doesn't leave at that time, it leaves at this time, or, and this was in one of the Sherlock Holmes ones I recently read, where Holmes knows that the train stops, the underground stops at a certain point, and there's an opening to the above the ground, or whatever, like some sort of hole. So he has that intimate knowledge. But how do you do that in the game? So one idea I had is basically set the mystery in a familiar surroundings. Like a game that, if the players have played the game in this city, like let's use fantasy as the default, and they've played it regular fantasy games in this particular city, so they start to become familiar with certain things and who these NPCs are, then set a mystery in that same city, and play with the things that they know about the city.
So, for example, they know that this one street vendor sells a thing, and the next time they come back, he's gone, or he's selling something different, or
he's gone, or the throne room. There's like if they're constantly going into the throne room because they interact with the king a lot, something's different about the throne room.
Okay.
Or they know that this the night watch does patrols at night, and suddenly they're not doing patrols in a certain area.
You could use that if there's, for example, details that they notice the first time going through that have changed, maybe the second time. But I would add a caution to that it relies on the players first going back to the same area that they had experienced before, and also that on them checking or recalling the details.
Well, I think what Lyle was suggesting is you play a couple games that's not a mystery,
right?
So that the players and the characters are familiar with the setting,
right?
And then you switch over to play a mystery game, and that's when hopefully the players and characters will notice that things are out of place from the last time they've been there.
Which is tough, because then you have to deal with the obfuscation of items. For example, I think we've talked about it before. If the characters walk into a room and you say, you know, it's a 10x10 room and there's a pen sitting on a desk, they immediately go for the pen because they know it's important with that description.
Right.
But instead, if you describe that there's a desk and a pen on the desk and there's some shoes in the corner and a nice lounge chair, something like that, there's lots of items, so the pen may not seem important, even if it is. Same thing if they are familiar with this area, this world, and you change the details on them, they might, A, have forgotten since the last time they played, or B, just not noticed that you've changed something. So
Which is fine, but then if you're using the rule of three,
then
if you're only, like, you're kind of, your problem is that you're assuming that you would only be using these type of clues. But I'm just saying, if you want to add these type of clues to your arsenal, the change of habit, or the missing item, or the sudden appearance of an item that wasn't there before, that's really hard to simulate. So what you'll need to do is to use something very familiar. Like, you can't have Sherlock Holmes going, you know, but the train leaves at this time.
Yeah.
If they don't actually know that the city even has trains.
Exactly. You could roll a local area knowledge thing, but that's nowhere near as effective or as dramatic as the players figuring it out themselves. So I agree. I think it's a great idea. I just think it would be a little bit difficult. But then again, that said, a lot of things that have the best payoffs are difficult to do.
But so, I think, if you're familiar with something, if you're familiar with something and you've noticed something over a span of time, I think your eye is immediately drawn to things that are different. So, like, after you've adventured in this city for a while, and you go back to an area, maybe it's cheating a little bit, but I don't see that big of a problem by the GM saying, and you notice that the fish vendor is gone.
Which
he's been there for the last 3 months, and today he's not there.
So, which is fine, but it's kind of giving them a clue directly that I would hope that they would catch organically.
I guess,
but again, there's no problem with it, but if they can notice it themselves, then it's more exciting.
How that would play out, for example, is they go... I'm not sure how the fish vendor gets into
it. I was just thinking something big.
No, I understand. I was trying to use that example, right. But I don't think I can.
Maybe he was murdered.
Yeah. But let's say the captain of the guard. Like, that's so much better.
Who's that fish?
But it's the captain of the guard, and they're like, oh, is it Balian? Oh, so Balian. Mm-hmm. And you're like, no. It's a new captain of guard. So you use their assumption, mm-hmm. and then when they try to act on that assumption, you're like, no, it's a different...
Oh, yeah. And that'd be really good, especially even if you didn't answer, is it Balian? They just go in to meet the guy and, oh, hey, that's not him.
Or if they go to... You know, let's say there's tunnels underneath the city that of Longblade's Peak that mm-hmm. you created. Chris had a series of tunnels underneath it.
Yeah.
And we use that quite a bit to go. But what if we go up to on top of the hill or the volcano to the hole that was always there and the mm-hmm. hole is no longer there?
Mm.
It's now sealed shut.
Like, that's something, the players and the character would immediately notice.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So I don't think it's a problem for the GM to say, and the hole's sealed. Yeah. And you're like, whoa, what?
Yeah. Here is a definite caution, of course. Like, let's say you have a map of your city and you have one tavern that's called
the Stinking Goose.
The Stinking Goose, great. And
good name.
Then what you do is the next time they do it, you change the Stinking Goose to the Green Leaf,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah, but the players never went to the Stinking Goose.
Yeah.
They never interacted with anybody there. So you're relying on them looking at something very passively
mm-hmm.
and then spotting that. I think that would be quite a challenge. Yeah. But what you would need to do is, who did they interact with before?
Mm-hmm.
Where did they go? What would they probably notice? Were they going through any secret passages? All of those things. And then take those elements and then make them part of your mystery.
Yeah.
So that's sealed because, obviously for a reason. It's not just like sealed over.
Oh, the passage.
Yeah. The passageway isn't sealed over because you just wanted to have it sealed over mm-hmm. and so that they could scratch their heads.
Right.
No, obviously the criminal did that. Or the adversary did that.
Yeah.
Something else that could possibly avoid that is we talked before in Secret and Lies about sort of hidden social roles.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this could be an opportunity to do hidden common knowledge roles, to use a Savage Worlds term, right? So once the players have been in this setting for a while, you can make common knowledge roles for them in secret,
mm-hmm.
and you can essentially make like a list of them, and then when they go to these places, or when they get asked about the train schedule, or things that someone who frequents this area would know, you can refer to these scores that you've written down and say, no, you know that the train leaves at 7:35, not 7:45. Or if they missed the roll and they don't know it, then you wouldn't give them that information.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a way to, I don't know, give a sense of familiarity with this setting that someone who lived or had been there for a while would know.
Yeah.
Without kind of, I guess, making things too easy, because there was still that random element of a die roll.
That's a good benefit. It's a really good benefit that you could use with any of the D20 systems or with GURPS as well, is because they have the single die type for you to just say, give me a D20 roll. And if you have the character skills, you can pull that.
Or I was thinking you could even do it just beforehand, right?
Don't
tell them what the roll is. Mm. Just if the GM has the character sheet, you just look at it, okay, well, Chris's guy has a common knowledge of this, that, and just make the rolls.
Before them. Another way you could possibly avoid any trouble with that is to make your clues non-temporal or not based on a specific place. For example, if they need to find, again, the same example as before, this pen leads to the killer. I don't know why it's a pen.
This pen truly is mighty.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking that.
Quite the pen, I tell you what.
Because it's a secret blade.
But instead of saying that, okay, this pen will be found in the top drawer of the desk in the top floor of the library, just say that, figure out that this pen could be in a drawer somewhere so that it's a clue that is modular. You could put it in several different mm-hmm. places just in case the characters miss out.
If it makes sense, all the places that would make sense.
Yeah, if it makes sense. I mean, if it needs to be up in the library and they find it down in the kitchen, it's like, whoa, someone left a pen down here.
What's
in the kitchen?
Shiny pen doing in the sewer?
It must have happened down here in the kitchen, which means it's the cook who did it. And you're like,
I think
maybe the pen is a terrible example. I think the best example for it is information given from NPCs.
Yeah.
You know, they can either get it from some information from the police. They can either get it from a cop on the beat, or they go to the police station and talk to someone.
Well, just
there.
The fact that it's information from an NPC, and the NPC themselves are mobile, then you can drop the NPC pretty much.
Trying to walk down the street, and the NPC keeps walking in front of
you. Yeah, yeah.
Where are you going?
Hey, guys. Hey, guys.
Maybe we should ask him some questions.
Yeah, exactly. Wait a minute. Haven't we seen that guy walk by about 5 times? Yeah. But, yeah. I mean, like, if they go to, like, a tavern, then the guy could be sitting at the tavern. You know, right. They go down to the docks, the guy could be inquiring about, I don't know, a ship. Basically, no matter where they go.
That guy is there.
That guy is there.
He might be the suspect.
Well, no, I'm not saying they
you
see
You have
him.
To be careful there, because then it's like, yeah, you're in a tavern, unless you're going to list 20 people.
Yeah, I wouldn't...
And he's there, and then you go to the dock, and you list another 20 people, and he's there.
Well, no, I wasn't... make it a piece of information to say... Here are the requirements for this person to know this kind of information. They have to be like a professional mm-hmm. in something like that. So anyone who matches that list yeah. could be a...
Yeah, that'd work. But I wasn't implying that you would have to meet that NPC multiple times. It was just one meeting.
No, that
but
itself could be a clue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just thinking, no matter where they go, that NPC is there for that one piece of information they get.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you can make somebody do something suspicious like tailing them.
Mm-hmm.
And they notice the tail, and let's say the person gets away, and then later on, you notice that person's in wherever you go.
Yeah. And that's actually a pretty common thing used in moves as well, that they find somebody tailing them, and he's not very good at the job, so they just right. go beat him up and get some information.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned red herrings. What do you guys think of red herring clues?
Yeah, this one's tough, because when I read Justin's article, he recommends against...
First name basis?
When I read Mr. Alexander's article, he...
J-Man.
He recommended J-Man. Against red herrings because players have a tendency to run with information that they get.
Yeah, they create their own red herrings.
Yes.
Like running with scissors.
So, yeah, I was thinking... Actually... Going back even further, I liked the idea of red herrings before I read his caution on it, but yeah. I agreed with him. But then again, you brought up some good points about why they might be valid.
Yeah, I think everybody, like Mr. Alexander or Ms.
or Justin, as Chris likes
to call him. Or Lisa Steele, they don't necessarily say don't use them.
Mm-hmm.
They just say be really careful and maybe limit it to one
yeah.
per story. I think, and I'll try not to spoil this particular story, but the Hound of the Baskerville, there's a good use of a red herring
mm-hmm.
in that the red herring has kind of a point. The point is not, it's a false clue,
mm-hmm.
so it's not as if this red herring is going to help you solve the mystery. Well, what it does is help you eliminate suspects. So, in a sense, it could be helping to solve the mystery,
mm-hmm.
but you have all these different motives or all these different suspect people. And you go down that one trail, the red herring,
mm-hmm.
and now you can find that they're not the killer. Perhaps they're reliable, or maybe you helped them with whatever their problem was,
mm-hmm.
and now they'll help you. You've turned these NPCs into allies.
Absolutely.
So I think you could still have false clues, but at the end of it, it does lead to something.
There's a reward for following it.
Yeah.
Mm. Again, I think that would be tenacity.
Yeah,
that would be better than just. They follow it, and they're to find out nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say, I think possibly the reason that GMs are in favor of, or not in favor, but the reason why people think you need to include red herrings is because as the GM, when you're writing the story, you see all the connections perfectly in black and white, and you can follow everything,
mm-hmm.
and it's almost impossible to look at this mystery from the other side of the GMing screen. And to your eyes, it looks way too easy, and so you feel the need to toss in some red herrings and dead ends.
Right.
But then on the players on the other side, they didn't build the story from the ground up. They don't possibly... The whole point is they don't know what's going on.
Right.
So everything... Not everything, but it's going to be more confusing for them than it was for you as a GM who wrote it.
And
so,
like you said, Lyle, they're going to create their own red herrings.
Yeah. Oh, I know when I do that. And like, the first session going, ugh. They know who the killer is because it's so obvious. They've met him. He's huge.
Yeah.
Obviously, somebody huge and hulking did this crime. Or when I had I had like an Enemy Within storyline, and when I made one of the players the kind of the betrayer,
mm-hmm.
and I did that in game in front of the other players with some kind of a little bit of obfuscation of handing the player something written, which is actually explaining what's happening to them, that they've basically been taken over by the shapeshifter. Mm-hmm. But I'm speaking, and at the very first line I say is, please ignore everything I'm saying now, mm-hmm. and just keep reading. And I start talking about something else. Mm-hmm. And then after the end of that session, I'm like, oh, that was so obvious that what was on the paper was nothing to do with
what I said. You don't have my blushing to tell. Imagine me trying to run a mystery and it's like, okay, so we're going to go talk to, this guy over here. It's like, blush. We're like, oh, we know who it is. All right. Why is Wayne wearing a mask during his mystery game?
Yeah, I ran into a little bit when I was running the Longblade Peak campaign in that there were elements of the world that I'd built in that turned into red herrings just because they were there.
Such as that Temple of the Evil Priest we wouldn't let go?
No, that one was actually part of the mystery. Oh. But, for example, in the courtyard of the palace, there was a gnome, and he was a gardener, and he made lots of different shapes. And he actually had a lot of information that could have helped you earlier on in this mystery. But when you guys were near the end of it, you'd already solved the mystery. You started going through it and say, oh, look, there's a gnome there. You just hadn't met the guy before. And then I was like, what's this gnome doing here? What's he doing? Oh, is it that important? Sorry.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I don't remember that.
Actually, I said out rather, and you know what? He's a red herring. Don't worry about him. I just said it because I didn't want to deal with that.
That's probably why we don't remember him.
Oh, okay.
But I think what you said just a moment ago, Lyle, is really good, that if you're going to put in false clues in there, give the players rewards for following them up. Don't make something that's going to complicate the story, because it's probably complicated enough.
Right. I think a good thing, and I know this is just standard advice for game masters and gaming groups, is to, after every session, is to talk to your players, if you have the time. Mm-hmm. Just a few minutes and say, what did you like?
Yeah.
What do you like and what you didn't like? What happened?
Yeah.
Or doing recaps before you start the next session. And those are definitely really important in a mystery, because then you'll start to see, wow, they didn't get a thing.
Yeah.
Especially, like, for example, if they met the killer and they're doing the recap and they're saying, oh, yeah, then we went here, and they don't even mention that the killer was there.
Yeah. You know he needed to make another appearance.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, of course, you don't want to go, and did you meet anybody?
Yeah.
Did he seem suspicious to you?
How would you rate him on the could-be-a-killer scale?
But you can do that also with a recap as well.
No, that's what I'm saying. You can either do after the session or a recap.
Yeah.
Is to see what the players got out of it.
Yeah.
Sometimes, if you do I know you make good use of a obsidian portal for the
session recaps.
Session recaps.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, Facebook for session recaps. But sometimes in a mystery, you might want to assign a player, and that player is as the secretary, and the player then polls the other players.
I tried everything. I tried giving you guys extra experience. I tried just asking nicely. None of you wanted to write out recaps.
I don't remember that either.
You just said, I brought it out of the table, just out open, and you just said, no, don't want to do it.
Really?
Yeah. Well, it was, at that point, it was just the two of you guys, so Wayne's like, yeah, all right, I'll do it, and then you didn't.
Oh, yeah.
Well, at least I was honest.
Yeah, you probably knew I wasn't going to do it. But no, I think what you just said is kind of an argument for modular clues, right? Like, if you go through the session recap or the drawn a blank, the
napkin head.
My burka.
Sorry. So anyway, if you do the session recap and you realize that the players haven't even mentioned the important clues, right?
Or right.
The clues of the story. And if those clues are only tied to a specific place, then you're going to have to come up with a reason for the players to go back.
Yes, very true.
To backtrack. But if it's...
But then you could drop in clues to...
Send them back.
Yeah, send them back.
Yeah, I that's definitely something you could do. But if they're like modular clues, you wouldn't have to come up with another clue to send them back. You could just pick it up and put it in a new place.
Yeah.
And which isn't the same as saying you change who the killer is. You're just saying that, this clue that didn't necessarily have to be here but was, can now just be ported to a different place.
And if maybe there's always redressing. If they missed something in a scene, then you just recreate the scene, redress the scene so that where... another place they visit may also contain that clue.
I like the idea of modular clues, of course, but I wouldn't want every one of my clues to be modular, because some of them should be really tied to a location or a specific person.
Yeah. And some
because
of them
that
can be.
Yeah, because that could lend to the credibility, for example, of the information that you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
Like we were talking, unreliable narrator.
Right. I think that is a danger. Like, the more modular the clue is, the more generic it has to be to fit in its location.
But a nice mix, because if you're getting all these modular clues, and of course all of these clues are leading to the final revelation, and you don't have to make it that you need, I've got seven major revelations, mm-hmm. you need to hit all seven.
Of course not.
Because if you're doing that, then it doesn't matter if you're using the three clue rule and the rule of seven. You've made it so they have to hit through each one. Mm-hmm. Then it's probably going to be too difficult.
In fact, I might even recommend making each revelation, giving them the ability to find out, say, if we're talking about a killer, who the killer is. Maybe even on the fourth revelation, that has a chance to figure out who the killer is. It's a very big cognitive leap, maybe too difficult. But then the next one is easier. The next one is easier. And by the time you hit the seventh one, it's all but telling them, this is the killer.
I don't know if I would even put
an order on them?
Yeah, an order on them. Or I don't know if I would even...
That would be tough.
Well, I think because you often break it down with, for example, the final revelation is, this is the killer, right? And then from there, you have to break down into other revelations. It's kind of almost more like a pyramid.
Yeah. I mean, I know it could be really unsatisfying if the players, just out of dumb luck, not a cognitive leap, but just out of chance, kind of confront the person, right? Mm-hmm. So... It would be really unsatisfying to kind of have the person reveal themselves and end it there. But
what if they're not getting it?
Well, if they're not getting it, and if they don't ask the right questions, then the killer would just tell them what they want to hear, and the story would continue. And then
you have to make up...
No, because you still have the other clues there. What I'm saying is you have these clues planned out, but you haven't set a number that the players have to meet... Mm-hmm. Before the showdown happens, or before things happen.
Yeah, that's what I wasn't saying that at all. I'm saying that maybe the first three revelations that they have, and built up through whatever clues, that allows them to make another leap. For example, they find out that there is a murder mystery going on in this city, because they find bodies and whatever. So that's the first revelation, that there is a mystery here. Second revelation is that...
it's a pretty easy mystery.
Hold on, there's a dead body!
Well, there was three different ways you could have done. You get the noise of it hitting your car. Looking out the window, seeing the dead body.
The feel of the splatter of the blood on your face. Whoa!
When you go to work in the morning, say, hey, my car! what other thing? No, so... Maybe the first few revelations is that there is something going on, or that it leads to a group of people, of suspects. What the next kind of revelations you have is that you don't have to get all of them to realize who the person is. Each one has a chance. It's kind of clues that give you bigger clues, so that you might be able to figure out who done it.
I think the division here is... Is Wayne saying that each clue, you could actually solve the mystery with one clue?
That's what I was saying before.
But what you're saying is you're describing a very linear progression.
No, I don't.
Okay, that's what it sounds like.
Because clue A leads you to other bigger clues, which mm-hmm. leads you to a third tier of bigger clues, leads you to the finale.
Sorry, and just to do, maybe not entirely linear, but you've maybe divided it into three tiers.
Yes.
So you could get... the first three clues in any order, but that's just going to lead you to the second tier?
Well, I was only imagining three tiers, basically. The basic ones that introduce the mystery to you. Yeah. And then the next set of clues, they all point to the final person. But just having one, it's hard to figure out who it is. Once you have two of those clues, maybe it's easier to figure out. And if you have all four of those clues, then it's really easy to figure out who done it. You don't have to choose them in any order. And after you get the first of those second-tier clues, you might figure it out.
Yeah.
But it's probably a very difficult thing to figure out. For example, maybe you find out that the murderer is someone working at this company.
Yeah.
That's a revelation. Of course, there's 20 people work at the company. You could guess, that it's this guy and go and arrest him, but probably not. Instead, you find another clue that, the murders happened between this time and this time. Well, that's when this group of people is off. That, and it kind of narrows it down into where mm-hmm. you guess it. You don't have to get all of them, but once you have all of them, it's a very easy jump to figure out who it is. And that way it kind of guarantees that the players in the end will be able to figure out who it is. Yeah. It just might take them a long time if they can't figure it out. It might take a short time if they're able to guess really well or figure it out well.
I was imagining almost like a net.
I was just thinking, for example, using the workplace, because that's actually the one I was thinking of as mm-hmm. well. is you get to the workplace and there's 20 employees and they're like, you know, F it. Let's just get all their addresses and break into all their houses. Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, that's kind of like brute force. But you had your other revelation was mm-hmm. if they actually go into the guy's house, they're going to see the wall of pictures.
Right.
Where they're obsessed with that person. You're like, well, that's kind of like was a big reveal.
Yeah.
Now, of course, they weren't going to randomly go to that revelation probably straight away. It's mm-hmm. like, let's just break into all the houses in the town. Mm-hmm. So you, but they've, instead of getting clues to go into, you know, let's narrow it down to find out which one, they're like, no, let's, we've got the time, we'll break into all of them. Mm-hmm. So basically they skipped all they three skipped of those that. Clues yeah. Yeah. to get that to that revelation. You're like, wow, okay, boom. Yeah. Yeah, and you went from one to from 0 to 100 in 6 seconds.
Absolutely. And that fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that Lyle said it pretty good. That's what I was saying. I wasn't thinking you bust into their houses. I'm thinking the players, okay, well, screw it. We'll bring them all in. And we'll not interrogate them all, but we'll question them all, mm-hmm. right? And you don't have anything to go on, but they could, out of dumb luck, or they could say, you know what, I didn't like that guy. Let's follow him up. Mm-hmm. And they could skip a bunch of steps and get to the end conclusion. But if they found out that, you know, that guy has an alibi that's false, mm-hmm. then it helps them solve the clue a little bit more. But I guess I'm kind of rehashing what you said a little bit, Chris.
But this is a good opportunity, though, for the active adversary. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you break into somebody's house, maybe the adversary can know that. Hmm. But somebody's been in my house. They're on to me. So they then flee. So they're not going to be waiting for you where right. you expect them. They're not going to go back to work. They're not going to go back to their apartment. Mm-hmm. Now it's kind of a chase. So then you can take a break. Mm-hmm. And then the next session, yeah. you have different revelations trying to find the adversaries.
An entirely new mystery. Yeah.
Yeah. But you're not cheating because it's still the same person. And they're rewarded. It's like, so we figured out who it was.
Yeah.
Yes, you did. Well done.
Unfortunately, we're a little bit too late.
Yeah.
Or you tipped them off. Mm-hmm.
Now, if you had a very passive adversary where it's like, in the drawing room, and it's like, oh, yes, it is.
You've caught me.
Yeah, and then it's like, bring in the cops, and you're like, I always wondered about that, and Columbo is like, they don't just, like, tackle Columbo and try to beat him to death. But they always just, like, kind of sit there, and it's like, oh, foiled. I guess that looks like 50 years of prison for me.
Because they're that kind of criminal.
Yeah.
They're the white-collar criminal. Like, oh.
Are you sure you don't want to finish your tea, your fugu tea?
I thought this was tingly.
All right.
All right, yeah. Thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online, www.idleredhands.com, idleredhands.com. Listen to us on Stitcher, on iTunes, on DriveThruRPG. Post some comments on the website or in our forums. We'd love to hear from you. And, yeah, we'll see you guys next time.
Thanks. Bye.
See ya.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.